Hello! Today I would like to interrupt the stream of Silmarillion Seminar and Faerian Fantasy Class episodes briefly for something special I haven't done in a while, a Tolkien chat. First, however, I'd like to make an announcement. The spring courses at the Mythgard Institute are now open for enrollment, and I'm very excited about them. We're expanding our offerings to two classes in the spring of 2012. I'm teaching one course called The Making of Myth, C.S. Lewis and J.R.R. Tolkien. I'm really excited about this one. We're going to be looking at Lewis and Tolkien's works in parallel, at places where they're considering a similar idea or telling a similar story. They're in Back-Again stories in The Hobbit and The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, for instance, or creation myths in The Aino Lindale and The Magician's Nephew. We'll be looking carefully at the similarities and the differences between Lewis's and Tolkien's stories and ideas. It should be a great learning experience for both Tolkien fans and C.S. Lewis fans, and I find that neither of those groups gives the other author quite as much credit as he deserves. The second class we're offering this spring at Mythgard is on Harry Potter. It's called Taking Harry Seriously: The Artistry and Meanings of the Harry Potter Saga. Now, I'll be the first to admit that although I've generally enjoyed the Harry Potter books and have respect for many of the things that Rowling accomplished in them, especially in the early books, I've never really felt that they stood up to serious scrutiny in the way that both Tolkien and Lewis do. But I'm only an amateur when it comes to all things Hogwarts, and enough people whose intellect and judgment I respect have disagreed with me that I wanted to give people a chance to prove me wrong. After all, academics and literary critics have spent 50 years saying that Tolkien doesn't deserve serious consideration. So should I, as a Tolkien scholar, turn around and scoff in the same way at the more recent fantasy phenomenon? So this spring, Mythgard will be offering a course which will be team-taught by three of the leading Harry Potter experts in the world. John Granger, Travis Prinzi, and James Thomas have written and edited 12 books between them on Harry Potter. If you're a Potter fan, you may know them as the Potter Pundits from the Leaky Cauldrons podcast, or the hosts of the Hogshead Pubcast and the Hogwarts Professor. I'm myself very much looking forward to auditing this class. It should be fantastic. So, where on earth can you work toward the master's degree by studying Tolkien, Lewis, and Harry Potter with world-renowned scholars from the comfort of your own living room and at tuition rates among the lowest in America? That would be the Mythgard Institute, of course. Visit www.mythgard.org, mythgrd.org, for more information and to enroll in classes for this spring. Okay, now that my little commercial message is over, let's get on to the Tolkien chat. I am joined in this episode by David Perlmutter, a professor, administrator, and columnist for the Chronicle of Higher Education. He and I got together over Skype to talk about two of his favorite intellectual hobbies, Tolkien and military history. But first, I'll let Dr. Perlmutter introduce himself.
My name is David Perlmutter, and I'm a professor at the University of Iowa in the School of Journalism and Mass Communication. I'm also director of the school, so I'm the chief administrator.
Great. Great. Yes. And it's great to have you with us. And of course, David has just been confessing to me his sort of secret clandestine interest in science fiction and fantasy things. And we were just kind of talking about, different conferences and, kind of the mix of academia and fan stuff.
Yes. I went in my life, I've only gone to one fantasy conference, and that was, I believe I was 11. And I went to a Star Trek convention, although there were many other genres there. This was when the Dungeons and Dragons was huge, the science fiction role-playing game Traveler, but it was mostly Star Trek. And there was two observations. One was Leonard Nimoy. Yes, Leonard Nimoy was giving a talk. And in the middle of it, he sort of put his hand over the microphone and whispered to somebody, "Could I have a glass of water?" And I think about the first 300 people in the front rows ran out to be the one who would get Leonard Nimoy his glass of water. And I just, because I always had read a lot of history, I had this vision of Napoleon at Austerlitz saying, "Je suis besoin de..." And 300 guardsmen, you know, throw aside their bearskin shakos to run to get the emperor a cup of water. And it was a very interesting parallel towards the worship of the charismatic hero. And then the other incident I remember from this conference was an elevator opened. And you know how sometimes at hotels you'll have different conferences or conventions of groups that don't really quite match each other?
Yes.
And I swear it was a church ladies conference, and they were all wearing big hats and very silky, poofy dresses, and they got into the elevator, and 5 seconds later, two guys with Spock ears, two orcs, and a guy dressed as Satan. And, you know, they're just all having these conference conversations, and oh, you know, this was way before digital photography and smartphones of any kind, and cameras and phones, but oh, years go by, I still wish I'd had a photograph of that meeting of minds.
They didn't talk to each other, did they?
No, I think they just were so focused on their own conference business that they just didn't, you know, process that, let's see, I'm going to go do a panel on how we can smite Satan, but here's Satan himself. Maybe we can ask him directly on how he feels being smited, or well, anyway, the point. I just think people get very internalized in these worlds, and sometimes I guess that's one way you can tell the quality of an author's creation is how deeply you can become enmeshed in the internalities, I call them, of a world, and not have to make up your own. And this is what I find fascinating about Tolkien, is that, as we both know, he was a professor, and he was a professor of English, Old English literature. He was a great language scholar. I've read a couple of biographies of him, and he was truly an amazing scholar.
Yeah,
he must have been a fantastic teacher too. Although, as I understand it, he had sort of a funny accent or just a slight voice tick, and so he was a little bit hard to understand unless you listen. What is the story that he would start with the initial words of Beowulf, which are like whit or something like
yes,
that.
Yes, yes, class is the yes.
Yes, and the class would, for years, assumed he was saying quiet. I'm sure you told that story and I missed it in a previous.
Yeah, well, basically the main thing that I've always heard about this is that he tended to speak so quickly that he would stumble over his words almost. He would speak in these like bursts, these quick bursts of speech, which, especially if you weren't used to it and you weren't ready for it, were pretty hard to understand. What people say is that once you got used to his conversational style and once you became acclimated to it, it wasn't that hard to understand him. But yes, he was very, he would get very, very rapid fire, stumbling over the things that he was saying, and he just kind of wouldn't go back. But yeah, he used to start off his classes by reciting, well, not every class, but his Beowulf class, he would start off by reciting the first 50 lines of Beowulf in Anglo-Saxon, and then just kind of move on.
Right. Well, my introduction to Tolkien, probably like everybody else, was reading it in school. I think I was like 8 or 9, and a teacher assigned us to read The Hobbit. And I was interested. It was a good story, and I remember buying like the Guide to Middle Earth or something. It was like a pocket handbook of the terms of Middle Earth. And I think I embarrassed myself. And I don't know whether I was actually stuffed into a locker for doing this, but I came close to when I would pull out my Guide to Middle Earth to explain what a Balrog was. And did he have wings? No, he didn't have wings. You know,
right.
That was important to me then. It's less important to me now. But what struck me then is, okay, then I started reading Lord of the Rings. And I realized something, which to this day I've always carried me as the essence of why I love Tolkien, because I love history. And the thing about Tolkien is that it's almost as if he's not a fantasist. He's a realitist. Mm-hmm. He created a world that was so deep and so rich, and every little detail is so worked out that there's almost nothing left to imagine independently. It's almost all covered, especially now with the huge output of Christopher Tolkien of all of these manuscripts. And it's almost as if you found a lost civilization. These archaeologists uncovered a lost civilization with these immense chronicles of kings and like personal diaries of monks or something. It's just so big, and it's so fascinating, and it's so beautifully filled out. It you know, like there's role. I don't do this. Don't have time to do it. But these role playing games now, where you can wander around
in
thousands of miles or something, and you know every rock has a snake under it. It's all been thought out. But this was one man's mind. It really is a truly amazing literary achievement. above all other things, plus just being really interesting reading.
Yeah, and you know, it's the thing that I find really fascinating. I mean, thinking back over the two of those things that you were just saying, is that on the one hand, as you say, it's so carefully worked out that there are few, at least within the portions of the world where the story takes place, there's just so few things that are left out, few white spaces to just kind of fill in. You've got the white spaces around the edges of the map, like we don't really know what's south of Harad and we don't really know what's east of Mordor, but within the realms that the story is concerned in, the whole thing has been rounded out very fully. But of course, the interesting thing is that, kind of paradoxically, as so many people have found, it also leaves, by how thoroughly he has filled it out, it has also created this tremendously fertile field for imagination, you know, it's so easy for people to lose themselves and immerse themselves. I don't mean lose themselves in a negative way, but really immerse themselves in it, because it is such an intellectually satisfying experience to immerse yourself in it. And I think that's one of the things that people find really attractive, in it too, that there's so much for the imagination, to kind of hang on to and work with, within all of these systems and things that he has worked out and developed. I think that's one of the things that really gets people. And I'm thinking of what you were talking about his being a realitist instead of a fantasist. And, you know, I think of this, especially when I'm talking with Tolkien fans especially about the films, and, you know, talking to people who are sort of purists and object to some of the changes and alterations that are made in the films. And I find that there's a difference, in talking to Tolkien fans compared to talking to fans of other works when they're talking about film adaptations of books and things. That is, many times people who, you know, I think, for instance, just to make a comparison, my wife is an enormous Jane Austen fan, and I like Jane Austen very much too, and the two of us are always interested when they come out with a new adaptation of a Jane Austen film. And
does she call you Mr. Darcy?
No.
Because I think you look exactly like the gentleman in Pride and Prejudice. Really, if anybody, just please go on.
That is extremely flattering.
Professor Olsen's website, and just really tall, dark, handsome. Really, that's why she picked you out, no doubt. Yeah.
Fortunately, she met me before those films came out, though only just. But anyway, no, when we're watching the adaptations, you know, there are lots of times where we will disagree, sometimes violently disagree with some of the interpretive changes, that are made to the characters. And sometimes these will be very comical and the story will be altered in crazy ways. But there's not the same sense when Tolkien fans object to the films. There's this sense of, like, you are making a factual inaccuracy. Like, you are simply guilty of you're getting it wrong. And I can really sympathize with that. I mean, I do, and I have many times on the podcast sort of defended the right of people, you know, somebody like Peter Jackson, who is retelling a story in a different mode, that it's, you know, it's a different story. It's not the same story. He can't tell exactly the same story. It's, you know, you can't do that. But I am sympathetic to that impulse and that feeling, because, and I think that that is one of the effects of the thoroughness with which Tolkien has built his world. It, as you said, it feels like history. It doesn't feel like one person's story, which, you know, another person might retell.
Fantasy writers. I mean, I'm a big Game of Thrones fan. I think what George R. R. Martin did was spectacular. The HBO adaptation is excellent. I think they made a lot of correct choices. A few I would challenge, but when my wife and I were watching Game of Thrones, We exactly what you're saying. We talked about, like, yeah, that Tyrion Lannister, great casting. He makes the part. We never said no. You know, according to the Chronicles, Tyrion was 3 inches taller, and I
right.
can prove it if I go through, you know, Chronicle 47A, letter 17.
Right.
And so as somebody who grew up with a deep love of history, my mother was Greek, and always we just had a lot of history books around the house. I mean, both my parents were university professors. I mean, the joke is on my father's side, I come from a long line of rabbis and teachers, and from my mother's side, I come from a long line of military officers. So a sort of interest in military history and in history in general, I think, was just destined and, I guess, doomed for me. So what I wanted to get a chance to talk to you was about the military aspect of Tolkien. And interestingly enough, I think it's something that's rarely talked about. I don't hear a lot of discussions about warfare in a general sense. I think people are sort of focused on many other questions. Now, you probably can correct me here because you must have a lot of students who've done papers, but I'm just sort of curious, has anybody done a paper on battles in Tolkien?
You know, it's funny because I actually also think that that's a little bit under focused on. That is, there will be some people who will point out similarities between, say, Tolkien's description of certain battles and the treatment of warfare in Anglo-Saxon works like the Battle of Maldon, for instance. Looking at some kind of similarities between the, you know, sort of the ethos of Tolkien's work and the ethos of these other earlier warfare stories. But, you know, more often the sort of hottest thing to talk about in Tolkien studies now in relationship to war, is World War One and Tolkien's World War One experience. And that's the impact of his World War One experience, in his early life on Tolkien's creative world afterwards. And this of course has been, every, you know, for the last five, 6 years, people have been talking about this ever since John Garth's book came out, Tolkien and the Great War.
And the funny thing about that for me, Professor Olson, is that if you knew nothing about Tolkien, the biography, if just you picked up The Lord of the Rings and it was like the manuscript of the Battle of Maldon where you're missing the first couple pages and missing the last couple pages, you just didn't know who wrote it and when. Maybe you were at an airport and you just never heard of it. I actually deny that you could tell anything about the author's experience of war from the manuscript. In other words, if you just read it without the knowledge of his actual background, I don't think you'd say, oh boy, this is somebody who went through World War One.
Right.
Because those battles that are depicted, and I don't claim expertise over every single comment, but I'd like mostly to talk about The Hobbit, The Lord of the Rings, and then The Children of Húrin, in terms of battles and war. And I'm really less familiar with the Silmarillion, I guess just taste and everything. But I can't think of a single battle which was a Western Front trench stalemate, for example. And now, somebody could argue that, well, maybe the battles express the kind of war that first does show horror of war. I mean, it shows the terrible suffering of war, but also maybe shows the kind of war that Tolkien wished he had been fighting, which, of course, the British and the French and Germans all marched off. You know, before the autumn leaves fall, they all marched off thinking they were going to fight the Franco-Prussian War or
right.
the Napoleonic Wars and it'd be a decisive battle and the clash of the struggle of nations and boom, you know, somebody would win. The idea of absolute stalemate, some people had predicted it based on the American Civil War and the Boer War and so on. But there really, no general said, you know, we're going to fight for four and a half years, and it's mainly going to be an economic will of attrition. And that doesn't go on. I mean, the classic Tolkien battle, I mean, I think describes almost all of them, is that the armies line up. There is some description of strategy and tactics. Like, and I'll just take the battle of Unnumbered Tears in The Children of Húrin. That may be less familiar to your readers, so I'll just talk about The Children of Húrin, which of course is set in it's the First Age. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Okay, yeah. So it's a great battle between the hosts of the alliance of elves and men before the gates of the great fortress of Nargoth.
Of Angband,
Angband, yeah. There's a lot of interesting Tolkien music on the web, and there's a Battle of Angband I was just listening to. But the hosts of the elves and the men ride up essentially to this not really well described fortress. I mean, you don't really get a sense of like it's got this many keeps and
right.
this many murder holes and whatever. But it's a it's mostly underground, and there's some fleeting description of the tactics of Morgoth, as in like, you know, he planned to draw them in this way with one host, but keep another host in reserve. So some tactics are talked about in terms of surprise. A flank movement. You know, I mean, maybe this was Morgoth. Can I, you know,
right.
drawing in and there? And actually, now here's some interesting parallels. Is that both at Cannae was the classic, probably the most famous battle in history, where Hannibal destroyed an Roman army with I think was either two or three times his size by classically drawing them in to his center while he attacked them with the Roman army with much less and much. Less effective cavalry on the two sides. And so there's always been in military history this idea that generals have been obsessed with Cannae, where you in one battle completely annihilate the enemy army. And if Hannibal had, as Livy, the Roman historian, talks about, if Hannibal had marched on Rome that day, he would have conquered Rome. And famously, his brother-in-law, the cavalry general Maharbal, said, you know, Hannibal knows how to win a battle, but not to win a war. And, you know, so he didn't march on Rome that day. But generals have been obsessed with Cannae. And, you know, actually, the German plan, the Schlieffen plan to attack France was a gigantic Cannae.
Right.
So there was, you could say, well, yeah, that Morgoth's plan at the Battle of Unnumbered Tears was sort of a Cannae, and it worked in that it lured the elves and men to attack him before they were fully ready, before they understood what, you know, his plan. But you don't necessarily get a sense of command and control in battles.
Mm-hmm.
You don't get this. There are very few they're not strategy sessions where the generals get together and lay down maps and Gandalf says, okay, now, you know, we need the dwarves to hold the right flank
right.
while we do a defilade with, you know, some eagles, and then we'll do this. It's very individualistic, and I think this is one of the keys to understanding Tolkien. And again, you can make a case that this is a rejection of World War One as much as it was reflected by World War One. It's a heroic age. I mean, it almost seems like, oh yeah, duh, right? You have to point that out. But that's the battles are won in a heroic fashion, where an individual has charismatic authority in the battlefield.
Yes.
Now, we know from many battles in history, or at least it was described that way, that that's actually true. You know, the Battle of Alesia in Gaul between Caesar and the Gauls under Vercingetorix. And there's
right.
this climactic this famous battle where Caesar has surrounded a Gaulish town where there's a huge Gaulish army, but then Caesar is besieged by another Gaulish army. So there's this donut battle. And this climactic moment, Caesar... Well, of course, he describes himself doing that, but it's probably true. Shows up in his scarlet cloak, and his personal intervention is decisive, and the Romans win. Now, there are probably hundreds of thousands of people fighting that day, but absolutely in ancient warfare and medieval warfare and in knights warfare, as well as, you know, hoplite warfare, a charismatic individual could be important. And Gandalf is a very good example of that.
Yeah, and of course,
charismatic person. Yeah,
of course, I'm thinking there too of Aragorn and also Theoden in the Battle of Helm's Deep. I mean, the moment that when I think of charismatic leaders on the battlefield, you know, to me the kind of archetypal moment of that in Tolkien is that moment when Aragorn stands up above the gate and calls for a parley to the orcs and wild men who are about to sack the Hornburg, and threatens them and says that not one of them will be spared if they don't leave right away. And then right after that, the sun rises and they charge out and the enemy is all destroyed. Now, of course, they have help in it. You know, their own individual heroic valor and leadership is assisted by the fact that, you know, the valley has filled with the army of the Huorns, which has cut off the retreat of the enemy. But still, it's, you know, there is that moment, the turning point in that battle, is not in any way a tactical one. It is simply that kind of not only charisma but just heroism when they just charge out into right. the enemy that vastly
personal
overwhelms
example.
Them.
Follow me. Personal example. And I wrote a book a number of years ago called Visions of War, and it was a history of the visual depiction of warfare. And I went back, well, as far as we can go, I went back to the earliest cave paintings, and since the book was written in the late 90s, I ended around the Bosnia War. And I had a chapter on war commandership and the earliest visual depictions, and some of them are really startling. I mean, we have a rock painting from Aboriginal Australia where you see two groups fighting with each other. And in the front rank, I mean, in other words, in the place which is closest to the enemy, you see a man depicted on each side who is physically much larger than right. anyone else on his size, wearing a different headdress, has different weaponry, and strikes a different attitude. Now, we don't know what they were. We don't know who these people were.
Right.
This is 5,000 years ago. But my God, we can tell he was probably the leader.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we've been. It's been very, very clear since really the earliest that we can see that a powerful big man, literally a big man,
yeah.
On the battlefield can be decisive, especially on that all important morale. Of troops.
Now, well, yeah, and I think, and of course, you'll know more about this than I will, but I mean, the stories that there were in some of the battles of Alexander the Great when he was the first man over the wall.
Absolutely.
Besieging,
famous,
I mean, which seems completely insane.
Yeah. And that if we didn't know it was fact, a lot of ancient warfare and medieval warfare reads like fantasy.
Yes.
My problem with Tolkien, and I always want to, when I use the word problem in Tolkien, I always want to say, you know, Tolkien, amazing achievement, really startling amount of, as I said, detail and thought, very good writer, storyteller, holds up as well today as he did 60, 70 years ago. I think what struck me when I was first reading Tolkien, at that time I was a military history obsessed 11-year-old, and I was also playing a lot of war games, and these were not the silly war games of today. These were big war games where you'd play war in Russia with like 2,000 pieces and like individual
right.
tanks. And I mean, it was very complicated, and you'd learn a lot about, it was really great as a historical education. You'd learn a lot about logistics and so on. And, well, what struck me is that Tolkien obviously intercedes himself. He is the deus ex machina.
Mm-hmm.
Some of those battles, I honestly believe if they actually were fought, they wouldn't have turned out the way they did.
Yeah.
It was obviously Tolkien had a problem with evil, and that he couldn't allow evil to win. Yeah, that's not a problem a lot of modern writers had. It is an issue that he had with himself. And so that's why some of the battles, frankly, get a little bit silly with just the continual divine intervention. I mean, here comes the eagles. Okay.
Right.
Yeah, I know the eagles are going to come. I mean, okay. What, you know, here comes the groundhogs to save the day. Or the puffins, you know, the divine intervention of the puffins, you know, giant puffins. The Battle of the Five Armies in The Hobbit. That was the first one I read that because I was thinking to myself, well, yeah, now, first of all, those dwarves. I know okay, I get it. Dwarves are hardy, right? Okay,
yeah.
I get it. But those 500 dwarves from Dane, was it Dane, son of Nain?
Yeah.
Haven't they just marched like 200 miles or something like that in full pack?
Yeah, they had just, marched with extra pack, we're told.
Yeah.
And they had just finished an all-night forced march.
Yeah, so I was like, well, all right. So they're like immortals or something. I mean, they're like 300 Spartans. I mean, they're really just tough. Okay, I guess so. But then the continual intervention of like, okay, well, the bad guys are winning, but don't worry, kids. It felt a little childish.
Mm-hmm.
It felt like when I played those games and I wanted one side to win and I would cheat.
Right.
Or you know, my friends and I would be playing a game and nobody wants to be the side that won historically because there's no glory in that.
Right. Right.
This leads to sort of uncomfortable stuff like, you know, you play World War II and you want to be the Germans and you want to win.
Right.
Because you get to brag that, you know, you did better than history. And it felt sometimes he was just sort of a kid sticking his hand in and saying, the orcs are winning. I'm going to stop it. And oh, eagles. That's it. Eagles. Eagles
yeah.
will come in. Now, I want to put this in context, if I may. And I'm sorry for going on, by the way. I get so excited talking to
No, finally. That's great.
It's 20 years pent-up conversation. okay, so what does that mean? It means that sometimes Tolkien has to disobey some of the historical and physical realities he's set up. And let's take the Battle of Hornburg, for example. Now, in Peter Jackson's film, that problem of sort of childish intervention, well, it becomes ridiculously obvious. Those are heavily armored steel plate infantry with long halberds and spears.
Yes.
I'm sorry, but no cavalry.
Yes.
No, it doesn't matter if they're mailed or whatever. First of all, horses would not do not charge halberds and spears and run right up to them.
Yes.
And second, you have a densely packed, you know, it would take tens of thousands, my lord. No, tens of thousands. You know, right. Okay, so you have 10,000 Uruk-hai right there in a dense pack, all with steel plate armor and halberds and spears. I'm sorry, you could send, you know, Napoleon's guard cavalry headlong to that, and they would be repulsed. I don't care if the sun's behind him or not the sun's behind them. That's essentially magic there.
I mean, I was thinking the same thing when I saw the film, is that they really make it seem just visually improbable. I mean, I was ready for them to sweep down and win the day once I wasn't surprised to see Gandalf's arrival with reinforcements be done somewhat more dramatically in the film than it was in the book. But nevertheless, the way that they, I mean, I was thinking the same thing. I was, you know, the orcs looked really actually quite prepared to receive the cavalry charge in exactly the classic way one does receive a cavalry charge.
They're going to go fight. I was trying to think of the ancient people their entire army was cavalry. It was not the Visigoths, but the North African the Goths that took over in North Africa. I can't believe I'm blanking on this now, but they essentially degenerated into nothing but an aristocratic cavalry. So when the Byzantines came along with a sort of mixed army, they knew how to defeat an all cavalry army that has no other divisions. Now, here was an all cavalry army versus an all infantry army. But these Uruk-hai, we've been for half an hour, we've been told like these are elite tough guys. These aren't these normal sniveling orcs that, you know, right. three 2-year-old children will charge them and they'll come sniveling back to Mordor. These are these supposedly super tough, and again, they're wearing what, 90 pounds of steel plate. I don't think a sword can even go through that. As far as I could tell, the Riders of Rohan had no archery.
There is some in the films there are a few archers on the walls. The majority of the archers in the film on the walls are the elves who come in kind of out of nowhere. In the book, Legolas mentions that they have. That their archers are pretty good, but that they're too few, that they don't have that many of them.
Yeah.
And so there's a reference in the Battle of Pelennor Field that they do have some cavalry archers who were helping to go after the Oliphants, the Mumakil,
So historically, how does cavalry defeat infantry? The cavalry cannot charge dense squares.
Right.
That was true in ancient world. It was true at Waterloo. The typical cavalry tactic was the ones that the Parthians and the Persians used against the Romans, which is harass them with archery, drive them crazy, break them up. Finally, when they break up into smaller units, then you can ride them down.
Right.
But again, there's no sense of tactics at Hornburg. There's just like Gandalf says, okay, everybody ride. I mean, there's just this dense mass of horsemen. They're not even divided into banners, you know. That's the way they do it. They just have like 10,000 guys who all just ride with their horses, you know, hooves brushing each other. So this is not a deep criticism of Tolkien. I think he's doing this for a purpose because I think the battles weren't as important.
Mm-hmm.
The battles were tertiary to the other parts of the story. And so the divine intervention, whether it's the ring dropping into Mount Doom or this intercession or that intercession, I think he didn't think them through personally. I felt they don't feel as carefully thought through as, say, the language or other.
Yes, yes. No, I agree. I mean, I think that it is clear that he's just not interested in battlefield tactics to the extent of really developing because I mean, there are some stories that, you know, there are other fantasists that you can read. Even as you said, Martin is clearly much more interested in battlefield tactics than Tolkien was.
And in
some fantasists who are really interested in that, the actual storyline of, you know, what are the battlefield strategies that, you know, that win the day in this one particular conflict, where that is itself a really compelling part of the story, it almost never is in Tolkien. I mean, some of the examples that you've given already, I think, are actually some of the more pronounced examples in Tolkien. That is, for instance, as you mentioned, at least in the beginning of the Battle of Unnumbered Tears, we get more tactics there than we get in most other places.
That's the tactics of the enemy.
Right, right, exactly. And the good guys have some tactics too, but again, it's pretty simple. Like, you know, that Fingon is supposed to engage the armies, and then Maedhros is going to come up from the other side, and they're going to take them as between hammer and anvil. But it's really crude tactically. It's like, your big army is over here, you're going to fight this other big army in the middle, and then our big army is going to come up, and we're going to fight them from the other side. I mean, that is tactics, but it is certainly not of the sort that you mentioned. Like, okay, we shall position our elven archers over here, and then, you know, the human cavalry will charge down this way and do he's definitely not engaging in that. In the Battle of Five Armies, we do get some tactics. That is, you know, we get, for instance, the sort of the forlorn hope of the humans from Lake Town who form this wall to induce the orcs to charge, and then so that they get drawn in between the two arms of the mountain, so that the dwarves and elves can attack from up above, and then you've got the orcs who creep up the other side of the mountain and then come down and attack them from above, and you know, so. There, again, some of the tactical descriptions that we get there, though again, it's clear that he's not sort of reveling in this, yet nevertheless, it is an important part of that story of the battle. But again, I agree with you, it's quite rare. You think of, for instance, I mean, in the greatest battle scene that he depicts, the Battle of the Pelennor Field at Minas Tirith, there's very little in terms of, you've got the great charge of Theoden and the riders of Rohan, and then it's just one, you know, by description, one mass of, you know, the good guys fighting against the mass of the bad guys. We get some details, as I said, of the pursuit of the Mumakil by the archers. We get some, you know, an elf helm going out among and destroying the siege equipment on the field, but very little, certainly much less than someone who was really, for whom the battle tactics were really a crucial element of the story would do it. I think some of it is, as you said, him being more interested in individuals. In the Battle of Pelennor Field, he's more interested in following first Theoden and then Éomer, through the Yon Field, you know, and then up to his meeting with Aragorn. But also, in a sense, I would say that his interests are kind of wider than that. That is, he's less interested in the movement of troops and in tactical genius than he is in sort of the much broader picture of good versus evil. Again, in the terms that you've mentioned, that those are, you know, the sense of, again, back to the Battle of the Hornburg, when the orcs are defeated, the orcs are not defeated by any kind of military supremacy. I mean, again, they had the military supremacy. In fact, they had almost won the victory when Aragorn is threatening to that they're all going to die. But that, to me, the compelling thing, the story that Tolkien is really telling there is in the last image of the orcs, the last we see of those Uruk-hai, is when they are retreating in front of Theoden, and they are confronted by the sudden and unexpected forest that has appeared down in the Coom, and they're cowering there, not sure where to go, in terror of the king and in terror of the trees, and then they decide to risk the trees, which turns out not to be the right choice. But anyway, so I mean that moment of the orcs standing there in fear and indecision, that seems to me the story that he is getting at, and that he is basically kind of casting aside almost any. See, I almost said realism, but that's not exactly right. Attention to that kind of detail, that is of exactly how, you know, which troops met which troops and how they were marshaled on the field, that gets kind of, is clearly superfluous to the story that he's telling in that moment.
Well, I think that's a key factor. So we started out by both agreeing, and I think anyone reading Tolkien, is that Tolkien is a master of detail. I mean, just, you know, to come up with, to explain one inscription, he'll invent an entire language. You know?
Right, right. Yes.
So when he chooses to paint something more diffusely, it must be a conscious choice. That's why I think the question of World War I is an interesting one, because I began by saying, I don't think you could tell if you didn't know from the story that this is this was somebody who suffered through World War I. Afterwards, maybe you can say, okay, well, maybe he's rejecting warfare. There's all, you know, the beginning of folly is to break apart something to look at it, the rejection of technology. You know, it's fascinating to me that the good people, the good, almost completely eschew technology,
mm-hmm.
especially in battle. Now, in the real world, generals are always looking for the latest edge, but
yeah.
the good people in Tolkien, basically they got a sword and a horse and maybe a bow and an axe. It's yep. Mordor and Isengard who are trying to figure out, oh, you know, see this, we'll build this siege engine and we'll gunpowder and all
and
of
that
this.
is yeah. even more, that is even more pointed in the Silmarillion, and to you can see snatches of it in the Children of Húrin. Morgoth has a very active and continuously running research and development department. He is always coming out with the latest war machine. The dragons are sort of the classic example of they are you know, a war project that Morgoth has built up from scratch and is continuously refining from Glaurung, who's the dragon in the Children of Húrin, and he's the prototype, but then he continues to refine it until finally he develops the winged dragons and finally, at the last minute and briefly, develops an air force, but then yeah. he loses.
So this is fascinating to me, is that evil has an active bio warfare program. You know, as you say, I love that image, by the way, that there's this lab in Angband or Mordor. Where
you really get that impression.
You know, you imagine, you know, Sauron comes along and says, so, you know, hey, I you know how much I've invested in this project? It's over budget. It's not delivering. You know, these siege engines keep turning over. I'm going to pull the plug here, okay? And pull the plug in Mordor means I'm killing all of you.
Maybe, that's right.
You know, throwing you into a fiery pit or something. I mean, by the way, this is what always I've always been interested in, the sort of Rosencrantz and Guildenstern of fiction and history. What's happening on the edges? There was mm-hmm. a famous episode of Babylon 5, which I think was completely brilliant. And for those of you who didn't watch Babylon 5, surprise, it was set in a space station. They're heroic characters who are fighting these big battles, but they had one episode where you spent the whole episode following two maintenance technicians, and the heroes who were dealing with some big battle and politics were in the background. So you only heard snatches of what the heroes were doing through the point of view of the guys who had to clean up the mess on deck 5, you know, and we're talking about getting off at 6 and they're going to go check out the new maid at the bar or something like that. And I've always been interested in what people were doing on the sides, or maybe the common soldier, the sergeant. If you saw the movie Last of the Mohicans, there's a scene where the British fort is about to surrender to the French. And the French commander comes out and on all his dignity and his men in full, you know, the band playing. And the British commander comes out and all his dignity and men marching. And the French commander says, it's a wonderful line, you know, you've done all that is required for the honor of your prince. And the British commander says, my men would sooner dig their graves and die here than or I think it's a British officer, says, "By men, the men would rather dig their graves and die here than, you know, surrender." And I'm thinking, I'm private number 17, you know, and right. I'm going, "Well, actually, sir, we wouldn't mind surrendering, you know, if we got good terms. I don't really want to die for this godforsaken fort here in the front, you know."
Right.
And so now that's the other part, is that because you're getting the hero's point of view, you know, the Samwise Gamgee angle on a lot of these things is lost.
Yes,
before the battle of, I'm blanking now, you're not learning about the common soldier as much in
right.
Tolkien, I felt.
That's true.
If you were doing an American war movie, let's put it that way. I mean, there's right. no GI orc. I mean, that's not true. You hear individual orcs sort of squabbling, and like, you know, the eye wants this and the white hand wants that. And I really thought that was a very good scene there, which gave us some perspective.
Mm-hmm.
But because he takes these battles from this, I guess, God's eye view, it's just that you feel there's things that he could have worked out, but he chose not to. And the Siege of Minas Tirith is a very good example.
Yeah.
And maybe I'm using Peter Jackson's visualization here, but like, here's a city on the edge of nothing. I'm thinking, where's the villages that support this city? You know, what do they eat? You know?
Right. Yeah. You know, and that is clearly,
where's the supply train?
Yes. That is clearly more.
10,000 riders. And as far as I can see, none of them has a backpack. You know, like,
yeah.
like what? They just had like one sausage or something. And,
right. know. Power bars. But
they're so densely packed. And I'm thinking, okay, so what? All 10,000 of them like go for the same patch of grass and the same. I mean, the logistics of battle don't make sense either. When the orcs march off to war, again, you don't hear about like, and then, you know, 5,000 carts, you know, 100 washerwomen, you know, 300.
Right, right. Well, I mean, Tolkien definitely did work that out more clearly, certainly in Minas Tirith. There are those references. There are references to the fact that Minas Tirith has great store long prepared of provisions that it has gathered from the countryside, and that it is, we do get a glimpse of how it is being supported, that is, how the city is being provisioned and supported by the fields of the lands south of it, from the Falas and down the Anduin towards the sea. And that is one of the reasons that everyone is really upset when they see the Black Fleet sailing up the river, because then they say, oh, well, then Belfalas is taken. And basically they know that they're cut off and completely trapped at that point, that not only can they not escape, but that all of their supply is completely cut off.
But miraculous intervention, it's not the Corsairs of Umbar.
Exactly. It's not.
Yeah. So I guess, Professor, I really wanted to have a chance to ask you this question. Do you see in battles in the whole span of the world of Arda, of the history of Arda, do you see the same level of realism anywhere that he expends on so many other things? And do you see this as a rejection of warfare, or just he's not as interested in warfare? I don't remember. I am 1/100th of the scholar of this you are, so I haven't read every letter, and maybe he has some letter where he talks about this and his choices of battle in detail.
Well, I mean, I do think that he was not. He definitely was not interested in war, you know. And I think about here. I'm thinking about the things that Faramir says about war, and the way in which, basically, Faramir's perspective on war, I think seems to me to come fairly close to being a fair description of how Tolkien himself seems to treat it in the books as a whole. When Faramir talks about the necessity for war, and how, you know, the men of Gondor are prepared for war and everything, but he says, you know, that they don't see it as an end in itself. And, you know, that he doesn't love war, he only loves the city of Gondor, which the armies of Gondor defend. And he is not interested in war as an end. And he talks about people, you know, and he points the finger at the Rohirrim, And even at other, in these latter days, the ways that, with the Numenorean blood being diffused and how the people of Gondor are becoming as lesser men, that they are becoming to see war as, as much of a sport and a pastime, as simply a necessity, in order to defend their land. And basically that seems to me a fair way, I don't want to say a key because that makes it sound really crude, but I think that that does seem to me to be a key that fits the lock here because.
Yes, and if I may interject
for
a moment here. So in this book, Visions of War, I talked about the nature of culpability in war. And I refer, of course, to the famous warrior of the 20th century, Bugs Bunny.
Yes.
years ago, I read the autobiography of Chuck. Chuck Stone. No, I'm sorry. It's when you're in a podcast, you forget these things. The originator of Daffy Duck, but he was the director of many Bugs Bunny cartoons.
Mm-hmm.
And he made this fascinating comment where he said, if you look at every single Bugs Bunny cartoon, it is a sort of description in miniature of the American view of itself and war, and that Bugs Bunny is always just sort of minding his own business. He's eating his carrots, he's doing something, and somebody comes along, a monster, a hunter, somebody comes and provokes him, and
right.
provokes him, and then Bug Bunny says, okay, you realize this means war.
Right,
and
right.
And then he engages in massive retaliation, which completely destroys the enemy, so that they wish they never fooled with Bugs Bunny. And Chuck Jones, was talking about how that was the essence of how America saw itself. America sees itself, and which I personally believe is actually true in many cases, that we're sitting here and other people coming, bomb Pearl Harbor. Okay, all right.
Right.
You got us there. Now we're going to flatten your country because you did this to America. And if you look at a lot of World War II films, that's actually stated. The Purple mm-hmm. Heart, the famous film about the captured American airmen, where there's a famous speech at the end of it where Dana Andrews, the American airman, said, we didn't ask for this war. You started it. Well, now we're going to blacken your cities and, burn your country to the ground. So there is I feel that there's that comes across in Tolkien too. That's very English as well. That England doesn't start wars. England responds to other people's provocations. The view of the Englishman versus the German. The Englishman just wants to defend his island.
Right.
Has no interest in conquering. But the German, the empire aside, the German wants continually more. And you can, this is, I after 9/11, I gave a little lecture in one of my classes, and I talked about the concept of the enemy, big E, mm-hmm. capital letters, big enemy, in which I made a list of interesting comments by Gandalf on the nature of the enemy and in Tolkien. I talked about the enemy, you can never negotiate with the enemy. Any negotiation is just a prelude to them grabbing more of you. They want everything. They are true totalitarians in that Morgoth or Sauron, they want everything. They mm-hmm. want all of Arda. They may feign a negotiation or a parley or something, but it's always a pretense towards further conquests. And this was obviously the view, which I hold, we still today, of conquerors like Hitler, that you could certainly make a temporary deal with him, but he was just playing a game to get you for the next conquest.
Right.
And so you could, and that was a view many held of the Germans in World War I as well.
Right.
So one way of looking at Tolkien's sort of grand view of war is exactly what you just said. And I think that just really sums it up, is that it's necessary. Tolkien was not a pacifist in real life.
Exactly.
The good people have to rally. They have to fight. There's no escaping having to fight. And in fighting, you have to be as brutal. I mean, let's face it, the good people, think about this, the good people in The Lord of the Rings engage in several genocides. They don't like spare. You don't know much, find out about orc women and children, but there's no mercy.
Yeah, well, and you think about the, and this is one of the things that people have the hardest time with when trying to think about it in terms of, you know, if you want to see Tolkien as responding to World War One and to the, you know, as a response to the horrors of war, and it's kind of hard to reconcile with, you know, Gimli and Legolas cheerfully keeping score of how many orcs they've killed, and you know, I mean, even sort of small references like, you know, Gimli's axe falls out of his belt when he bows to Treebeard, and Treebeard is like, "Oh, a dwarf and an axe wielder." And Legolas says, "You know, his axe is not for trees, but for orc necks. 42 he hewed in the battle." And Treebeard is like, "Ho, that is a better story. Like, you've slaughtered many people. That is fantastic." You know, I mean, there is this kind of unashamed delight in having even among the good people, even Aragorn. Yeah. Talks this way, and Gandalf
never misses an opportunity. Always chooses not to do what I think we would automatically demand of a 21st century writer, and that is to humanize the enemy.
Yes,
you know, so there's no moment when these two orcs are talking and they say, "Oh, my orc wife, Shedrack, she's had her first baby. I won't be able to see it until this war with the terrible humans is over." You know, Shedrack's mother was killed by an elf. You know, if Tolkien, and I respect Tolkien for that.
In fact, yeah.
I find it painful when these forced moments of humanization of the enemy are stuck into science fiction films. You know, I watched these as well, and I saw Battle Los Angeles. I don't know if you saw that.
I didn't. No.
It's an alien invasion movie, and it's sort of platoon level alien. There's no scene of like the president and the advisors talking about nuking him or something like that. Everything is from the point of view of a platoon of or a squad of Marines, and there's a scene where they kill an alien and sort of search him, and I was just waiting for somebody to pull out a little device and this holographic image of a woman alien and a baby alien appears, and they say, "Oh, that must be his family." You know,
right.
But they didn't do it. God bless them. You know. So Tolkien didn't do it, and I respect him for that. It's just that what that led to, and I think that again, I'm not saying it's a flaw, but I'm saying that it's his choice. And for those of us who want to understand him, have to understand his choices.
Right, it is. And I mean, and as he, one of the things that I think is revealing about this, especially when you read his letters, it's particularly interesting when you read his letters during the World War II era, when he was writing to his son Christopher while Christopher was on active duty with the RAF in South Africa. And he very frequently uses terms and names and concepts from The Lord of the Rings metaphorically, you know, as a kind of, as, not code words, but basically as ways to refer to the things that he and Christopher will both understand. And, you know, he talks about this, like, you know, he compares, for instance, at one point, he compares the Air Force, and his discomfort with the Air Force, with the idea of the Air Force, of Englishmen flying in airplanes to go bomb things. And he compares this to, you know, a battle to defend the Shire in which hobbits have to go up and ride fell beasts into battle, and that there's this something jarring about this, that it's, on the one hand, yes, it's good, yes, it's necessary, yes, I guess it has to happen, but it seems deeply wrong, the means that are being taken in order to do this necessary thing. But at the same, you know, probably the most famous and I think telling point when it comes to this, with sort of most applicability back to his stories, is when he says that, of course, in the real war, there are orcs on both sides. And I think that gives us a helpful way to understand the function of the orcs in the battles in his books. That as you say, he is, not only has he not humanized them, he's gone out of his way to unhumanize. I don't want to say dehumanize, because it means something slightly different, but not to have us relate to them in the same way. The only two orcs that we get in any way kind of close to, we never really get close to Grishnak and Ugluk during the Merry and Pippin sequence, but the conversation that we overhear between Shagrat and Gorbag at the end of the Two Towers is the closest, I think, that we get to the humanizing of orcs, where we hear the two of them and they're both of them complaining about their situations and how they really wish they could go off and set up on their own, with a few stout lads and where there are no big bosses. And now it's still kind of horrible because they're talking about, you know, their fantasy of setting up their own bandit, stronghold where they will, cheerfully waylay travelers and pillage and everything. But nevertheless, there's this brief moment where you are kind of brought inside of like, well, I can kind of see where these orcs are coming from. And I guess, they have some of the same motivations that we do. And I might feel the same way that they do under certain circumstances. But then that's immediately, well, not immediately, of course, people had to wait a while for the Return of the King to come out. But as soon as we get the beginning of the Return of the King, we see Shagrat and Gorbag stabbing each other and Shagrat stabbing Gorbag and licking his blood off his knife. And so like any personal connection that we might have had to think like, I can really see Shagrat's point of view, is kind of immediately underdone, or rather undermined, by the subsequent action. So yes, we don't get that kind of connection.
Right. And by the way,
the
I
bad
just
guys.
Want to say there for a moment that that's an important insight into warfare, because it's clear that one of the huge disadvantages that the armies of evil have is that they are essentially run by the whip.
Yes.
That no one dies for love of Mordor. People don't say, for Sauron and Mordor, follow me, man. It's like charge the enemy, because if you retreat, I'll kill you faster than they will. And so not that doesn't build for very good cohesion.
Right.
It doesn't build for very good support of other units. Also, and this is something else I find fascinating, and maybe we can, and we've already gone an hour, so we can end on this point. Although I'd love to have another conversation with you at any time, but the evil leaders never personally command their armies.
Yes.
They send them off somewhere. I mean, yes, Morgoth is besieged in Angband, but since his one fight with Finn, was it Fingolfin, right?
Yep.
Yeah. And he's wounded. And Tolkien tells us he likes to hide. He's afraid. Sauron, you say, it's such a huge advantage to have Gandalf there. If Sauron, I don't know, he can't leave that giant tower. Can he just like spirit down? Now they all try it once, right? Okay, so Sauron personally came out to fight. Mm-hmm. In the last alliance of elves and men, and Morgoth came out once, but the moment they're hurt, from then on they let other people do their fighting. You'd think, well, gee, wouldn't the horns, the army of Uruk-hai marching on Helm's Deep, it really would have helped them if Saruman had been there.
Yes. Yes, exactly. And of course, ironically, it would have saved Saruman too. I mean, he was trapped in his tower by the Ents because he didn't go out with his army. That's another kind of interesting thing to think about there too. Again, another way in which, and I think there you can see Tolkien being pretty deliberate about making that particular strategy or on the part of Saruman backfire on him. Had he not stayed safely in his tower at home, he actually would have been a lot safer. But no, it's true, and I would say that actually both of Morgoth and of Sauron, yes, Morgoth comes out to respond to Fingolfin when he basically is compelled to in order to save face in front of, basically the whip is going to be much less effective if he lets himself get called a coward to his face in the way that Fingolfin was. But when he's finally confronted in battle, when the Valar finally come in the War of Wrath, he is taken in the end, but he is basically trapped See, he fled into the deepest of his minds and sued for peace and pardon, but his feet were hewn from under him and he was hurled upon his face. He is yet unvaliant, as he says. He is cornered and yet unvaliant. And Sauron was that way too. I mean, yes, he came out and fought in the Battle of the Last Alliance, but only at the very end, like on the slopes of Mount Doom, when the enemy had basically won, that is, the enemy, his enemies being the good guys, had finally won, then he came out to fight, but only then. Had he been leading from the beginning, might things have been different. Definitely.
Now, you know, that just on one point, militarily, that is one instance where I'm thinking, again, the only people who are thinking through on tactics are the enemy. Now, yes, you know, if your army is hard-pressed, like, say, a lot of Alexander the Great's battles began with him vastly outnumbered, mm-hmm. and his strategy was, okay, I'm facing this huge army, but it's an army that's completely centralized around the person of the Persian king. So, okay, my loyal companion cavalry, ignore everything else, just charge for the chariot of the king of kings, the Persian
right.
king. And so you could say, well, okay, that was probably a pretty... The only tactic at that point that Sauron had was charge for the command force of the enemy, kill their kings, and break them.
Right.
And you know, it didn't work, but at least it was a pretty reasonable... choice to make.
right. Yes. Whereas Morgoth doesn't even try that, at the end, and he just, hides and begs. But no, that is clearly one of the big differences. You know, good leaders are not only are there in the front, but are self-sacrificially in the front. You know,
fly, and, you fools.
Yes, exactly. And Théoden's charge, and, you know, when he is way out in front of everybody else as they're charging into the field. I mean, he's not just in the front lines. He's advance of the front lines, in their great charge. And yes, the enemy never does that. And, you know, that I think is another, he was clearly interested in, you know, he had thematic ideas that he wanted to convey through his battles. But again, the battles themselves were not the story he was telling. They were the vehicle of the larger story. And that's why you get these patterns, even the repeated things, going back to your Deus Ex Machina point, you know, the eagles popping up again and again and again. You know, that's because that's one of the stories that he wants to tell. That's one of his points of sort of how.
Professor, I'm just thinking that maybe we can end on this this evening, because I think we've gone.
Yes, we probably should.
But it's just, so I'm 11 years old and I finally read The Lord of the Rings, and we had a very eager Tolkien master at my school, and so the other kids know a lot about the Lord of the Rings and the Hobbit, and so there was a soccer game with our rival school, and we were losing, and it was the last seconds, and I couldn't help myself, and I said, "Look, the eagles are coming." Some people got the joke. Other people just looked at me like, "Yo, wow, you are a hopeless nerd." You know, I guess I am.
That's pretty cool. Well, thanks for joining us. It's great to talk with somebody who has the kind of background on military history that you do, to be able to make these kinds of comparisons. It puts it in a very interesting context. Tolkien did know a lot of these things, and he would have been thinking, you know, if not actively thinking about things like the Battle of Cannae and the tactics there, he was certainly, you know, aware when you talk about, you know, heroism and especially battlefield heroism, that he's not only thinking of literary depictions of that in places like the Battle of Maldon, but thinking about that historically as well, and you know, and so I do think that it opens up some really interesting insights into Tolkien's interests and into a lot of what's going on in those parts of his stories when we actually do make some of those close comparisons. I think that's very interesting. Anyway, thanks for the call, and thanks for suggesting the topic. That was fun.
Well, thank you so much, and just keep up the great work. I'm sure you have a quite a fan base, and people from all sorts of backgrounds who really appreciate what you're doing.
Well, that has been really the most rewarding part of it. I mean, of course, Tolkien has so many great fans, and you know, has attracted so many just really intelligent and interesting people who really like to read and think about his books. And so it has been really, really fun and rewarding to be able to kind of be in touch with lots of people from lots of different perspectives. And I've been kind of surprised at the breadth of that. You know, I kind of expected, that, I don't know, I, when I started off, I had sort of an idea of, you know, that I would be primarily appealing to kind of a narrower demographic, but that has not really been the case at all. It's been, and again, it's, you know, I think really a testimony to, the fact that Tolkien has such a kind of surprisingly broad appeal in some ways. And also to the fact that I think that there are, you know, for me personally, you know, I've been very, very interested in the fact that I think that there are a lot of people out there who are really interested in being involved in an academic discussion. You know, I think whenever I watch TV and things like the History Channel and stuff, I always feel like, why do almost all TV networks insist on dumbing things down so much when, you know, my experience with interacting with people, there are so many thousands of people out there who are just thirsty for, you know, like an actually intellectually stimulating conversation and discussion to actually be a part of this kind of thing. And there are not all that many outlets for most people in kind of regular American culture these days. So,
and I want to tell your listeners, I'm an administrator, and so part of my job is fundraising. So, ladies and gentlemen, if you want to help the cause of Tolkien, please donate $3 million to Professor Corey Olson's college so that he can have the Morgoth chair of Tolkien's studies on his business card.
Yes, that would be cool. That would be cool. Yeah, but you'd almost have to name it something like that, wouldn't you?
Yeah. I would. I promise. If I do it, I will.
Very cool.
Okay. Thank you.
Well, thanks very much. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to another edition of Tolkien Chats. Don't forget to head over to www.mythgard.org to sign up for the spring course offerings of the Mythgard Institute. Thanks for listening, and Godspeed.